Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/hardcore history for your free audiobook download.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live
in infamy.
It's Hardcore History.
The Blitz Edition.
My original plan for this first Blitz edition of the podcast that we've done in a long time was to lighten up the topic a little bit. We figure here that we've had 10 months of the horror of the Eastern Front engrossing us, and it was time for something a little lighter, you know, the history of flowers or something like that. And between the time I picked the topic for today's Blitz show and the time it was actually in my hands ready to go, it morphed from this lightweight, kind of fun, interesting, different topic to break up the horrificness that you've been subjected to up till now. And it morphed into what it is now, which, as I look it over, is something darn near as dark as the Eastern Front. And I can't tell you exactly the moment when it crossed over from a lightweight, happy topic to a, you know, heavyweight, dark topic, but somehow we just seem to be living up or down to the Hardcore History name, no matter what we try to do. You know, ourselves. We have no free will, I guess is what I'm saying. And remember, we picked the name Hardcore History before, you know, the first episode was even done. Funny how it just tends to live up to the name no matter, you know, what my intentions. And so now another topic that's not lightweight and airy and fun, but just deep and heavy and, well, you'll see what I mean. I mean, basically what happened to me was a couple of ideas cropped into my head and I wasn't able to get them out, and those sort of built on top of each other and became, well, this. The first idea was I was watching, you know, the TV, some sports program, and they were running these public service ads during it for, you know, children who were victims of child abuse, you know, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, psychological abuse, all those kind of things which we know can impact a child so negatively. And then a little later on in the day, there was this story about this person being sentenced for some child-related crime to years and years and years in prison. And I remember thinking to myself that it's interesting that with all these societal messages that we put out and all the effort we put into preventing child abuse and educating people about child abuse and putting away child abusers and all this stuff, that we still have so much child abuse. And I thought to myself, gosh, imagine how bad that problem would be if we didn't make such an effort to combat it. And then I thought about the past and how they made no effort at all to combat it. Would you expect the child abuse problem to get worse? Well, of course you would. We all know, don't we, how important good parenting is to creating a good product in the end, don't we? We've all seen the news story about some offender that ends up in the justice system who's committed some heinous crime, and then his defense attorney will list the, you know, terrors of his upbringing, the way that they were raised, the treatment by the parents, you know, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes you'll look at this person who committed this heinous crime and say, well, this poor person never had a chance. Well, you can understand how he turned out to be this way. Look at how he was raised. Which brings me to the second thought that sort of forms the basis of this program. I couldn't help but drift off into the science fiction realm after I was thinking about this topic for a little bit. You know, there's a connection in my mind between science fiction and history, and I have explained this before. In this case, though, I was thinking about sort of an experiment on humankind, the kind that would be certainly unethical if we did it. So in my brain, aliens are always substituted for people. Because if people do this, we're like Nazis. But if the aliens do it, well, you know, it's like a zoo. And I have this idea of the aliens taking 1,000 little human infants from all over the world, same age, and taking them up to some secure environment, you know, an alien zoo, some planet where they're going to be allowed to develop naturally in captivity. And I always think, if you take this 1,000 children to this planet and you raise them completely wrong, what kind of society will they have built when you come back to visit and take a look and, you know, take some notes 1,000 years hence or 2,000 years? You know, from this time. If you raise the children all wrong, how different a world do you end up with? This is what got me researching what I thought would be a light and airy topic and turned into what it is, because I started looking into the history of children. Now, the history of children is something that is so much harder to study than I had ever planned for. I was shocked by how little there is on kids throughout history. Look at how obsessed we are now. When you go to the bookstore and there's huge sections just on, you know, raising your kid and child psychology and child abuse and all this kind of stuff. We're so aware. We've got to be the most aware society about this stuff in all human history. And then you look around you at how many problems we still have and you go, well, my goodness, what the heck were societies that didn't put all this effort and all this focus on preventing our kids from growing up, you know, in battered homes or being sexually abused or just being disciplined in what was the normal, you know, psychologically and socially effective way at the time, which would be considered abuse today? How did those societies ever raise functional adults? Maybe they didn't. And I was reading some of this stuff, and what you'll find if you delve into the history of children idea, and I'm not a historian, as you know, didn't know much about this topic. I became fascinated with those two angles, started doing the research, and you run into a group of people who call themselves psychohistorians. Now, this psychohistory thing took me a little bit of research to try to get a handle on. What it basically is a group of people who think that they have a new discipline for history. It's not even that new anymore, but, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, which sort of melds psychology and history. You know, they try to do to individuals and societies of the past the same thing that psychologists and psychiatrists try to do to individuals in modern society, right? Essentially put them on the couch and try to figure out, you know, where things became emotionally off balance and how do you deal with traumas of the past and all that kind of stuff. In effect, what they're trying to do is figure out if the early development and influences in the children of the past ended up impacting the societies that they created later. If you have a whole nation of abused and battered children, does that impact their history? Can you look back and say, wow, I can see why the Roman Empire did this. All you have to do is look back in the past and see where they were, you know, beaten by their fathers, something like that. That may be a gross simplification, but it's a little of the reason why you don't see more mainstream historians and anthropologists and other people jump on the psychohistory bandwagon, kind of a fringe sort of side to the history debate right now. And if you look at their theories, I think they take it too far sometimes, me, of course, not being any kind of an expert, when they'll try to connect something like child abuse in the Roman Empire to the foreign policy of the imperial, you know, state. That's a little too much for me. But, you know, you can see pretty easily, I would think, some connection between, you know, the way those people in earlier times were raised and the fact that they turned out to be different people. I've always wished for a time machine, as you regular listeners know, and I know many of you have too, judging from the email. And I'm always thinking about going back in time myself. Typical, right? Go drink in the actual sights and sounds and smells and interconnectivity of the past firsthand. But sometimes when I'm in my more different moods, I imagine turning the time machine onto the grab setting, where you just grab someone from the past and bring them to the now and, you know, walk around with them, see how they react in the mall or something. And whenever I do this, it quickly degenerates into some sort of a comedy movie as your person from the past acts out totally inappropriately in the mall because they're not raised, you know, to treat our society correctly. They're raised for a different time and a different place based on, you know, those people. But those people may have been terribly abused individuals. Which brings me to these psychohistorians again. According to people like Lloyd DeMoss, who may be the first person to identify himself as a psychohistorian, the children from the past were completely abused people. And the societies in the past didn't care much about children in the past. It's the psychohistorian's belief that it's a recent development that we actually look at children as people and empathize with them. To the psychohistorians, this explains why we don't see the kind of, you know, books and focus that we have now on children in our society in the past. They didn't care as much about them. And then when you hear, you know, exactly how they were raised, straight up in your face, you sit there and go, would it be illogical to consider that this had some sort of effect? I mean, if you say that child abuse does what we say it does, go to all the advocacy sites or the government sites that deal with child abuse, go get some books, and they will tell you that child abuse damages the victim severely and can sometimes damage society because it damages all the people around them. Sometimes they end up in trouble. If all that stuff is true, and I certainly think it is, are we to believe that the people from the past didn't suffer those same problems when they were victims of abuse? And if they did, And the abuse was on a scale magnitudes of order larger than what goes on in our society, because we're so aware and on top of this. Mustn't that have rippled through those ancient societies in the same way we would expect it to ripple through our own? But the opposite question is almost just as interesting. And that is, if for some reason it didn't work out that way, does it mean that the children in the past, through their culture or some other aspect we can't figure out, were somehow immune from some of the problems that we would expect our own children to go through if they went through the same kind of abuse the people from the past were dealing with? I kind of wonder, in those societies in the past, those brutal societies we talk about all the time, were those societies so brutal that it made brutal people? Or were these brutal, screwed up, child abused individuals the reason that their societies, you know, reflected this? It's a chicken and egg argument. For an idea of the scope of the problem we're talking about, here's what psychohistorian Lloyd DeMoss wrote. Quote, "Children throughout history have arguably been more vital, more gentle, more joyous, more trustful, more curious, more courageous, and more innovative than adults. Yet adults throughout history have routinely called little children beasts, sinful, greedy, arrogant, lumps of flesh, vile, polluted, enemies, vipers, and infant fiends. Although it is extraordinarily difficult to believe," he writes, "parents, until relatively recently, have been so frightened and have so hated their newborn infants that they have killed them by the billions, routinely sent them out to extremely neglectful wet nurses, tied them up tightly in swaddling bandages lest they be overpowered by them, starved, mutilated, raped, neglected, and beat them so badly that prior to modern times I've not been able to find evidence of a single parent who would not today be put in jail for child abuse. I have searched so hard during the past 3 decades, he says, for any exceptions to this extremely abusive pattern, that I've offered a prize to anyone who could find even one, quote unquote, good mother prior to the 18th century, the definition of that word being one who would not today be incarcerated for child abuse. No one, he says, so far has claimed the prize. Instead, historians have assumed that my evidence for routinely abusive parenting must be terribly exaggerated, since if it were true, it would mean that parents acted in direct opposition to their biological inheritance. And surely, he says, evolution wouldn't be so careless as to leave us too immature to properly care for our own offspring. It is not surprising, he says, that the existence of widespread child abuse throughout history has been viewed with disbelief." End quote. He also says, quote, "The evidence which I've collected on methods of disciplining children leads me to believe that a very large percentage of the children born prior to the 18th century were what would today be termed battered children." End quote. So that gives you an idea where a psychohistorian like Lloyd DeMoss is coming from. And as I said, I don't buy all the theories of these psychohistorians. I think they have a specialty, and they try to make the evidence sort of fit to their specialty, and I think most specialists do a little bit of that unconsciously anyway. For example, the psychohistorians like to talk about the long-standing human practice of infanticide, the killing of children, and then discuss how this practice affects the whole society where it happens. This is part of showing that adults didn't have empathy or see little teeny babies as people like themselves, well, according to the psychohistorians. And the psychohistorians have developed a chart where they had the stages of human history divided into segments. And the first segment is the biggest of all, and it goes from like caveman times to relatively recently. And they call that segment, that stage of human society, the infanticide stage. But you know, the fact that human beings have been killing our own infants, you know, throughout recorded history, that's not new information, is it? I mean, the scale is sometimes surprising when you get down into the nitty-gritty. You forget how common something like that was. I mean, a great many human cultures throughout history, I'm tempted to say off the top of my head, the majority of cultures throughout human history have practiced some form of infanticide. And many of us in the West get our first exposure as children to this idea of sort of a ancient state that permitted infanticide when we first learn about the Greeks, don't we? Have that, you know, you're 12 years old, 13 years old, getting your first lessons on Athens and Sparta, and that's when you run into that fascinating society that the Spartans created. You want to talk about a human experiment of taking kids to other planets and raising them all wrong. How about raising them all like Spartans? And it's fascinating. If you look at the life of a Spartan from childhood to adulthood, there are so many things in there that modern psychologists would say fall into the child abuse category. You wonder how any of these people reacted to anything. I mean, could you bring them in the time machine, put them in the mall and have them react normally? The funny thing, though, is that when we are taught about what the Spartans were like, a lot of these negative tendencies that would appall us if we actually had to see them or live with them sound almost noble. For example, the Spartan practice of taking newborn infants to a council of elders to be inspected. What this council of elders were looking for was any sort of deformities, whether the child was sickly, whether the child cried too much, whether the child just didn't look up to snuff. And if they determined that this was the case, they would have the child thrown off a cliff. And this was presented to me, at least when I was back in school, by the teacher, as almost something noble. It typified the Spartan seriousness about, you know, what they considered to be an elite warrior race, and it wasn't going to stay an elite warrior race unless you took just the best. It was like the Marine Corps or something, and we admired their ability to even sacrifice their own young to keep, you know, their standards high. That was how it was kind of taught to us, and that was kind of how we received it as students. Never really coming to grips, though, and realizing how unbelievably strange and atrocious such a custom is. Imagine being there, watching the infant get judged, and having a bunch of old men say, nah, toss that one off the cliff. Toss that other one, too. That's infanticide, folks, and it was routinely practiced, and when we're first exposed to it learning about Sparta, it doesn't quite come across that way. But this wasn't weird behavior of an unusual society, even though the Spartans were unusual. That's how lots of human societies behaved. I mean, take the Apache Indians here in North America, and we did a show on them before, obviously, and you would have a hard time finding better tribal parents than the Apache were. They were loving, doting parents. They almost never hit their kids. They had extremely strict societal taboos and mores that made something like child sexual abuse almost impossible. And yet, this people that are such doting, caring parents would strangle sickly infants or crybabies, you know, within days of the birth. They practiced infanticide just like a ton of other societies. Happened everywhere and was not uncommon. As I said, the psychohistorians actually have the majority of human history classified as falling into what they call the infanticide stage. And earlier societies didn't just kill children because they were a burden or they didn't want them or they were sickly. I mean, there's a lot of human societies that integrated child religious sacrifice into their rituals. The Celts did it, the Germans did it, lots of people did it. The most famous, probably, or infamous, has to be the Carthaginians, doesn't it? And it's interesting because we know about this alleged Carthaginian practice from Greek writers who either told the truth about this or have thrown out a piece of black propaganda that has tarred and feathered the Carthaginian name ever since. Because what the Carthaginians are alleged to have done is participate and practice religious sacrifices involving the killing of children, something that first world countries in that classical period of the ancient Mediterranean weren't doing anymore. It's an old-fashioned kind of practice, I guess you could say. And as we said in the Punic show, we're told in the Bible and in other biblical texts and from historians that the Phoenician people in the eastern Mediterranean, who are sort of ancestors and cousins of the Carthaginians, also practiced a similar ritual, so who knows, it might have been ingrained in that particular people. But what the Carthaginians are supposed to have done, according to legend, was they had a pit filled with glowing coals, and they had a statue of this particular god who was on the edge of the pit but had outstretched arms that hung over the glowing coals, and there was some sort of a mechanical device built into the statue where the arms could be raised or lowered, you know, at the pull of a lever or something. And supposedly what happened was the Carthaginians were supposed to put their infants into the hands of this god, and then the lever was pulled and the hands dropped, and so did the infant. Such practices are the kind of things that make me think twice about my idea of going back in the time machine, because sometimes I think, you know, it'd be great to go back and find out just how intellectual and advanced these societies are and have a good conversation with the Platos and the Socrateses and all the, you know, talk to Julius Caesar about high-minded things. And then you think to yourself, these people are just like I am. And then you realize you'd be just as likely to end up in the middle of some Carthaginian, you know, baby sacrificing ceremony and look at those people and say, you know what, we may have the same DNA, but we're from different planets. Makes you wonder if those 1,000 infants taken off to the experimental alien zoo are going to practice human sacrifice when the researchers come back 1,000, 2,000 years later. Now, as time went on, of course, infanticide on society-wide levels decreased. And you have to give the major religions a lot of credit for that. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, all taught that infanticide was wrong. And so something that in some societies, in a lot of human societies, was considered to be just fine, was all of a sudden not just fine. And this changed the whole way the practice was seen. This became something universally, at least in these places where these religions predominated, universally thought to be a bad thing. What it essentially did was move infanticide sort of into the shadows. Doesn't mean, of course, that it didn't continue. Mothers doing away with their own infants, for example, in private, is something we still have a problem with today, don't we? In the United States, you'll hear of several stories a year where a mother has either killed or tried to kill her newborns. And I think that researchers think now that this might be connected to something like postpartum depression, and they're researching how, you know, giving birth may change some women's mental state for a short period of time after the baby's born. But if you assume that that's a constant thing, that it's always been around, well, then maybe all the mothers doing away with their infants in earlier times is an example of postpartum depression in a society that knew nothing about any of these things. Apparently, though, it was so common, though, that when you read what the sources have to say, it's hard to believe. I mean, in the history of children, there are several quotes. One, they quote a priest in Italy in 1527 talking about walking down the streets of his Italian city and, quote, the latrines resound with the cries of children who have been plunged into them. And, of course, what he's talking about is that all down the road you can hear babies crying who have been thrown into the toilets. Imagine a society where walking down a street like that and hearing those sounds and knowing what those sounds were was common. According to C.J. Rolfe, it's still not uncommon as late as 1890 to see dead infants on the side of the road in London. That seems unbelievable. These are different people than who we are in some ways. Now, this practice of infanticide by this time is something that's done on an individual basis. Some mother does something terrible to her child or something like that. The things that are still okay in society, though, are things we would still consider to be abuse today. For example, the beating of children. I remember growing up, and 35 years ago, you would see some children in the neighborhood get beatings from their parents that were old-fashioned by the standards of the day. You know, pull out a belt and beat their children 15, 20 times on the back with the belt. Nowadays, you go to jail for that. Back when I saw it as a kid, it made all the kids uncomfortable because most parents didn't do that anymore. 20 years before then, that was pretty common. Shows you sort of the evolution of what we consider to be okay and not okay. Well, the person beating their kid on the back 20 or 30 times with their belt would be considered positively lax by the standards of 100, 200, 300 years ago, when beating was considered the preferred and proper way to raise, you know, good, well-adjusted adults. Remember that line, spare the rod and spoil the child? That's what this means. I mean, listen to what some of the beating instruments were 200 years ago, 150 years ago. Quote, this from The History of Children. Quote, beating instruments included whips of all kinds, including the cat-o'-nine-tails, shovels, canes, iron and wooden rods, bundles of sticks, the discipline, which was a whip made of small chains, and a special school instrument like the flapper, which had a pear-shaped end and a round hole to raise blisters. End quote. Think about subjecting your 7 or 8-year-old child to a device like the flapper that's going to hit them and raise blisters because it's specifically designed to do that. This is so that your child will grow up to be a well-adjusted adult. And truthfully, it's hard to blame the parents for not seeing the damage they were doing to their kids, because after all, this had been the way that they themselves had been raised. For example, Lady Jane Grey, who was a British royal family member, actually thought herself blessed to have parents who treated her in what was obviously an abusive way by today's standards, because she believed it showed that they cared. Now, assuming that's the message you come out of being abused as a child with, how is someone like a Lady Jane Grey going to treat their children when they have them? Obviously, she thinks her parents loved her because they abused her. She loves her children. You can do the math. That's what a battered society means, right? It becomes a cycle. It becomes hard to break. It also makes you feel blessed as all get out to live today, doesn't it? I mean, there were obviously, you can tell, good and loving parents throughout history. Maybe the chroniclers considered standard child-rearing practices to be beneath the interest of their readers or not worth inclusion into a grand history. And this has provided ammunition for the psychohistorians who can point to precious few examples of good parenting in the past. But even the psychohistorians have to admit that they were out there. For example, M.J. Tucker quotes Sir Thomas More, who lived in the 1400s, in a letter he wrote to his kids. Tucker calls More perhaps the greatest father of his age. And in a letter to his children, he wrote, quote, "It is not so strange that I love you with my whole heart, for being a father is not a tie which can be ignored. Nature in her wisdom has attached the parent to the child and bound them spiritually together with a Herculean knot. This tie is the source of my consideration for your immature minds, a consideration which causes me to take you often into my arms. This tie is the reason why I regularly fed you cake and gave you ripe apples and fancy pears. This tie is the reason why I used to dress you in silken garments and why I never could endure to hear you cry. You know, for example, how often I kissed you, how seldom I whipped you. My whip was invariably a peacock's tail. And even this I wielded hesitantly and gently, so that sorry welts might not disfigure your tender seats. Brutal and unworthy to be called father is he who does not himself weep at the tears of his child. How other fathers act, I do not know, but you know well how gentle and devoted is my manner towards you, for I've always profoundly loved my own children, and I've always been an indulgent parent, as every father ought to be. But at this moment my love has increased so much that it seems to me I used not to love you at all." End quote. And you can see in the way he wrote that Thomas More is not the only good parent in his whole society. He just contrasts pretty sharply with a lot of the other examples that have come down to us. And you listen to that quote by Thomas More and you think to yourself, well, here's a parent who obviously wants to do the best for his children. But even parents who felt that way could do great damage to their kids by simply following the prevailing wisdom of the time. Sort of inadvertent child abuse. For example, one of the common practices in a lot of human history, maybe all of human history until recently, was to give children liquor or opium, both for pain-relieving reasons, you know, if their teeth hurt during teething, give them some liquor, or to make them sleep, give them some opium. When I was born, it was still common practice in the 1960s to give children sleeping medication that was prescribed by a doctor. I remember my mother saying once, that children used to sleep better in the past, yeah, because they had sleeping medication. Well, those prescriptions simply were taking the place of the older human drugs, opium and liquor, for the same purpose. And you can't help but wonder whether or not this giving of opium and alcohol routinely to infants, and certainly if you had no problem giving it to infants, you probably didn't have any trouble giving it to children and teenagers as well. You wonder what the long-term effect on the brains of these kids would be if they'd been giving liquor to them all their lives. I mean, was this a whole group of people who were being raised who had something like fetal alcohol syndrome? Hard to know. Might explain a lot. Now, obviously, there's a reason we don't give opium and liquor to children anymore, because it can hurt them, and this was recognized quite a long time ago. The History of Children quotes a British doctor named Hume, who complains in 1799 of thousands of child deaths in that year caused by nurses, quote, "forever pouring Godfrey's cordial down little throats, which is quite a strong opiate, and in the end, as fatal as arsenic," end quote. So the good parents of the day are trying to keep their children healthy, and they're having their nurses give them what would amount to snake oil from a snake oil salesman today. Over-the-counter opium prescriptions that they think are doing their children good and that are killing thousands of them a year. Another practice that was something thought to be part of good parenting that you can't imagine doing today was this idea that your children would get a good moral lesson in right and wrong and justice by taking them to a public execution. take your 5 or 6 year old to a hanging or a beheading was thought to have a good moral effect on their conscience. Even anti-beating child advocate Mafio Vigio, a guy who's, you know, very liberal in terms of his parenting method for the day, quote, had to admit that to let them witness a public execution is sometimes not at all a bad thing, end quote, talking about children. I'm trying to imagine my 5-year-old and how she would handle a public decapitation. Now, one of the things they would often do when they took their child to witness the execution so that they would remember it was beat them, have a beating session to give them such a injury that they would remember it later. In the same way that, you know, when we're adults, we can remember hurting our leg or breaking an arm or something when we were children, some particularly painful and traumatic experience. Some of the parents of the past sought to imprint that sort of memory on you artificially. If you'll remember a terrible pain you had as a kid, let's inflict it, and you'll never forget this lesson we learned today at the execution, son. In fact, this idea of beating the children so that they would never forget it actually has some examples you can look at throughout history where it had nothing to do at all with raising a better child. For example, there was an Anglo-Saxon legal practice in what we call the Dark Ages where kids were beaten just so that they would recall a given day for legal reasons or for evidence purposes at some sort of trial. I mean, that's child abuse serving the role as some sort of weird notary public function for those societies or something. Think about that. We're going to beat the children so that in 20 years, if we need to refer to this case, the children will have remembered this day and what they saw here. There's something about Dark Age justice that just never loses its charm. Let's just put it that way. The last thing, too, that you wonder about, you know, when you talk about a child going to an execution and does that traumatize them or doesn't that traumatize them, I think about the everyday sights and sounds they were exposed to. I mean, take some of these kids in these tribal warrior societies who were certainly seeing people being killed or even tortured in front of them, you know, at 5, 6, 7 years old. Now, in our modern times, we're worried about our kids seeing violence on television or at the movies. What's that line? Some advocacy group has added up all of the simulated murders and killings that kids see on TV, and they'll say something like, by the time an American teenager is 15, they've seen, you know, X number of murders, implying that this creates a desensitization, right? And the kids are less good people because they've seen all these simulated killings. Well, what if you saw real ones instead? Or real torturings in front of you from an early age? And before I go any farther down that road, I need to point out that there are people who email me who say that this is completely the wrong way to think. And they emailed me, for example, after we talked about the battles at Cannae and these terrible, you know, hand-to-hand struggles in the Punic Wars. I had suggested that maybe those people suffered from what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder today after being through a battle like that. And they said, you're applying modern concepts to past people, Dan. Those people grew up seeing animals butchered, seeing people killed. It didn't impact them the way it would impact a person with modern sensibilities today. And they could be correct about that. But if they are, it also means that, you know, me showing my child simulated murders is going to hurt them. You showing a 5-year-old in the past real murders is not going to hurt them. Get back to that idea about a culture maybe inoculating or vaccinating those kids against things that would hurt our children today. Now, the next subject you have to understand if you want to understand why the psychohistorians think the people from the past had so many, well, let's just say psychological issues, is the idea of abandonment. Now, abandonment as a psychological issue is going to sound very lightweight and maybe even a little contrived after you've been discussing things like infanticide or child beating. But the psychohistorians will suggest that lack of sustained contact between parents and children damaged a lot of these children in the past. I mean, we automatically assume that there's this human bond between parents and children, don't we? Heck, we just quoted Thomas More at length, living in the 1400s, who talked about that same bond, right? At the same time, we have only to look in a newspaper or to the television news to see stories of mothers who don't appear to have that bond every day. And those stories in the past of all the infanticide and the mothers abandoning babies, in some cases they may have been compelled by circumstances to do so, but you've got to imagine a lot of them must not have had a lot of empathy, you know, must not have had that connection, that natural one between mother and child. The History of Children quotes famous French royal party girl Marie Antoinette in a letter to her mother, showing that she maybe didn't exactly have that natural bond either. She was talking about her little daughter and the pleasure that she got when her little daughter recognized her as her mother in a room full of people. And she wrote her mother, quote, "I believe I like her much better since that time," end quote, insinuating that she didn't like her all that much before. Now, was this a form of abuse? Something that damaged generations of kids to the point where it impacted stuff? Well, that seems a stretch for me. But if you say that it might have been, well, then maybe the enabler for this institutionalized abandonment, as one of the psychohistorians calls it, was the institution, the human institution of what was called the wet nurse. A wet nurse is a person who breastfeeds the baby of another. Someone often hired to do this. It's a very strange human institution, and in some cases goes back a long way. I mean, they used wet nurses in stories in the Bible, in ancient Babylon, in ancient Egypt, in Greece, in Rome. The History of Children says that the Roman wet nurses gathered at a place called the Colonna Lacteria to sell their services. So you need a wet nurse, you go down there and you sample all of the various ones that are there who are going to breastfeed your child for you. The History of Children says, quote, "Most parents who could afford it, and many who couldn't, sent their children to a wet nurse immediately after birth," end quote. Now, they don't say if this practice is regional in nature. Did they do the wet nursing all over the world, or was this something that was in certain societies? It appears, though, often because you can see that there's a need being filled. After all, how do you feed a newborn infant in an era before there are things like, you know, powdered formula substitutes? Got to have the milk. If the mother can't do it, someone's got to be found who can. And a lot of these societies did not believe in giving infants animal milk. Some of them would do it if it was a dire emergency, but others wouldn't do it at all. In medieval Europe, there was a belief that the child took on the aspects of the one whose milk it drank. So if it was a low-born milkmaid, then maybe they act like a peasant. If it's a goat, maybe they act like a goat. So parents were really in the market for someone who could feed their children breast milk, and it often wasn't the mother. Now, what would usually happen is they would send this child to go live with the wet nurse and their family for years. Oftentimes, the people hiring the wet nurse were nobility, and the wet nurses themselves were part of a middle class, what passed for middle class in medieval or Renaissance times, or low class even. So you have this interesting institution where the highborn are taking their children to go live for years with the lowborn and bond with them. I mean, Winston Churchill, highborn, of course, in the late 1800s had a wet nurse. And while he had an affectionate relationship with his mother, the person to whom he bonded and who he really had that sort of tender, sentimental feeling we associate with mother and infant, that was the person who was his wet nurse, and he loved her and was close to her until the day she died. Now, there's nothing wrong with a little infant bonding with someone who isn't their mother, but after 2 years to 5 years with the wet nurse, they took this child back into the home of the biological parents. So you've now ripped the child away from whatever parent they thought they had. Now, oftentimes, these wet nurses and their families were not very nice to the child, so maybe this was a blessing, but now you're meeting people who say they're your parents, and they're pretty much foreign strangers to you. Now, to give you some idea of how common the use of the wet nurse was in some places and in some eras, Lloyd DeMoss quotes a piece written by the police chief of Paris around 1780, estimating that of the 21,000 children born in that city every year, 17,000 of them were sent to the country to be wet nursed. 2,000 to 3,000 were sent to nursery homes, where this was done as a practice. 700 were wet nursed at home, so you have the wet nurse come in and do the job. Only 700 of the 21,000 were nursed by their biological mothers. So obviously, you have something here that's very popular for all sorts of reasons, one of which might be infants are not always the most fun to have around. We love them now and we celebrate them, but if you look at it objectively, they're not easy. And maybe mothers in the past looked at this as a way to avoid some of the tough stages of motherhood, the very early ones. The British were some of the earliest modern advocates that breastfeeding by mothers was a good and valuable thing. And Lloyd DeMoss quotes a British gentleman named Robert Permell, who complained in 1653 of the practice of, quote, both high and low ladies of farming out their babies to irresponsible women in the country, end quote. So you can begin to see this idea that maybe there's something wrong with turning your infant over to a person you hardly know to be breastfed for a couple of years and then bring the kid back into the household. But that shouldn't be so surprising when you look at some of the records from, say, the 1700s and 1800s, where you can find writings from people who make children sound like they're a litter of puppies instead of human beings. The casual giving away of kids is astounding. For example, the History of Children quotes the mother-in-law of a 19th century gentleman who is writing about a baby that's been promised to some other people, and she says, quote, yes, certainly, the baby shall be sent as soon as it is weaned, and if anyone else would like one, would you kindly recollect that we have others, end quote. And boys, as is often the case in societies where the girls become part of the male's family, boys were preferred over girls. One 18th century woman wrote her brother asking for his next child. She wrote, quote, if it is a boy, I claim it. If a girl, I will be content to stay for the next, end quote. It does sound like puppies or a litter of kittens, doesn't it? On the other hand, maybe this was what a society without the technology to create surrogate parents like we do now, their version of surrogate parenting. I think we all know that the outright selling of children, though, has always been common. You hear stories of that today, and there are parts in the world where this is still done. In the past, selling children was, you know, profitable business and was done in most places. I mean, just imagine right now if we had no laws protecting children from this happening today, people would start doing it tomorrow. And in the past, if people didn't just outright sell their children, sometimes they just farmed them out for labor. After all, child labor is still a problem in the world today, isn't it? And before child labor laws, we put people to work all in the Western world at very young ages. Children were often given dangerous jobs like going down into the mine and working in factories. You can look at the way that American slaves were treated in the agricultural South, and a lot of times as soon as those children were old enough to motor around on their own 2 feet, they were out in the fields picking cotton and doing hard agricultural work. The past was no different. Many of you will recall the institution in medieval times of the page or the apprentice, where young kids, sometimes as young as 5, usually a little older than that, would be sent to a neighboring castle or community, and sometimes the children from the neighboring castle or community would be sent to your castle or community in order to begin their, you know, working life. Serving food, cleaning food from the table, taking care of the animals. Imagine your 5, 6, or 7-year-old already hard at work. Was not uncommon at all. Is that abuse? Depends on your point of view, I guess. It's illegal today, and probably for a good reason. Now, what about those other parents, though? The ones who had that bond that Thomas More talked about and that we all assume parents and children are just born with, that connection. You don't need anyone to tell you how to treat your child. You love it, and you want to treat it well. Well, in the past, it was very common for fate to impose that abandonment, even when the parents and children would have liked, you know, more intimacy. For example, people tended to die younger in the past. This surprises no one. The type of people who tended to die especially young, by the way, were often mothers who were giving birth. It is frankly appalling how deadly childbirth was for the mother throughout most of human history. I mean, if you're going to have 6, 8, 10 children, which a lot of women did, and each one of those deliveries is dangerous, it's like playing Russian roulette, and a lot of mothers died. So children growing up in the past with one or both parents dead was much more common than it is today. Did this affect the psychology of the people growing up? Well, if you're an orphan, I'm going to venture a guess and say that that has an effect. Now, the infant mortality rate was as shocking as, you know, the one of mothers dying in childbirth. Elizabeth Worth Marvick writes, quote, infant mortality rarely dipped below 25%, and in hard times frequently reached 75%. The life of a newborn hung by a slender thread, end quote. There are people out there who will suggest that the very fragileness of human life in the past, and especially the life of, you know, newborns and young children, which were so precarious, that quote says, in hard times, 3 out of 4 young children will die, throughout history. This may have led, according to some people, parents to keep a certain emotional distance from their kids, simply to protect their own sanity. I mean, think about this. In this modern world of ours, where we do pay so much attention to the children, and the bookstores are cluttered with the best ways to raise them and love them, the worst thing most parents can conceive of in this modern world is losing a child. Now imagine being a part of a world where losing children is a common experience, and sometimes losing lots of your children is a very common experience. Might you try to maintain a certain distance to protect yourself? Imagine how hard the mortality rate was on parents who loved their children in the past. Imagine their collective pain. Maybe this explains a desire to not get so close. Author Joseph E. Illick writes about a couple of colonial families to give you an idea of what they went through in terms of the pain that parents losing children had to deal with. And in both these colonial families, he talks about, they both had 14 children. Only two of the kids survived the parents in one of those families, and only one of those children survived them in the other one. Imagine losing 13 children. Makes you feel like the psychological trauma involved in the child issue affected more than just the children. But if there's one area in this whole question about whether the people of the past are, you know, child abuse victims, there's one area that's harder for us to deal with as modern people than any of the other areas we've talked about. Yes, worse even than things like infanticide. And that's the part that involves children and sex. Makes me feel kind of queasy and weird even discussing it. But we have to acknowledge, and the psychohistorians kind of force you to confront this, that the modern taboos we have, you know, organized around sex and children, are often totally absent from the cultures of the past. This often makes for history that just seems perverted. In Greece and Rome, for example, there are lots of cases showing kids and sex in the world of antiquity. It was clearly what we would call pedophilia today. But, see, here's where you start to get weird when you think about these societies from the past. You know, going back in your time machine and just hanging out in Greece or Rome and then realizing there's pedophilia all around you. But is it really pedophilia if you're the only one who notices it? This is where the past becomes a weird maze of moral questions that are impossible for normal people in a modern society to deal with. We talked about whether or not culture inoculated people from certain kinds of negative things happening to them. Were the children in the past who were involved in what was considered to be normal adult child sex practices somehow not affected by those? There are some who will say that in a culture where this was okay and not frowned upon and there was no shame attached to it, that the children did not suffer any long-term effects. This was not abnormal, which makes the whole world of the past seem abnormal to us. The psychohistorians will say that that's not the only kind of sexual abuse that was going on. Things like incest, things like rape, these things were much, much bigger problems than they are today. Imagine if you took all of our rules and society's structures and the penalties and everything away from our society, what would happen? Now imagine these societies where some are even taught in their pagan religions that this is okay. Emperors are doing it. No one goes to jail, and no one thinks much of it, and, oh yeah, the little kids are available from the slave market for a reasonable fee. And it's funny, too, because it's weird from another angle. It's not just that children are being seen as sex objects and are being victimized. Sometimes the children themselves are absorbing the whole sexual nature of their society and exhibiting traits that we just can't imagine little children exhibiting. For example, there were sailors who wrote 400 years ago of encountering some of the people on these Pacific islands that they had discovered, and the women were very sexual and very overtly displaying sexuality, but some of these women doing this were as young as 10 years old. And you think about 10-year-olds doing that, and that just doesn't jibe well with the modern mind. You know, we just think that's wrong, and it's hard for us to go any farther. Like I said, even talking about it makes me feel queasy and weird. But if you go back in your time machine and you encounter, you know, sexually active and promiscuous and, you know, aware of their sexuality 10-year-olds, that's going to freak you out a little bit, isn't it? always makes me wonder why our ancestors didn't see how damaging this stuff was. I mean, they're not stupid in ancient Greece, for example. If child abuse is causing all sorts of problems for their society, why don't you hear more about them doing things to stop it? Or it becoming shameful or bad or frowned upon or taboo? I can't answer that. You just wonder why the people in the past who were smart people didn't see the same things we see today and try to put a stop to things that they see as damaging. Now, one of the other things that might really explain a lot of this, though, is how old people were in the past having children. I mean, it's common knowledge, isn't it, that people in the past, in a lot of time periods and a lot of places, often got married at much, much younger ages than what we're accustomed to today, right? And I don't mean to play into a stereotype and a fallacy here, because sometimes those ages were not as young as we tend to believe. You could look back at a lot of these ancient societies and you might be shocked at how old they expected people to be before they got married and before they had children. Nevertheless, it was still common in a ton of time periods and a ton of places for people to get married at the age when puberty first set in. I mean, you have to imagine a 12-year-old bride marrying a 14-year-old groom and having that be common. And of course, that turns into a 13-year-old mom and a 15-year-old dad. Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, fictional characters though they were in their early teens, weren't they? And in that time, in that place, it would not have been uncommon to see them married. How much does that impact their child-rearing skills, though? See, today we have lots of young couples as well, and a ton of them do great jobs raising their children. I can only think of myself, though, in that situation. And I've often said that I am a much better parent having had kids in my early 30s than I would have been had I had them in my early 20s. The extra decade or so of experience really helped me, and I can't imagine having had them when I'm just barely entering adolescence. If you imagine our society with millions and millions of 13-year-old moms and 15-year-old dads without any of the educational support system we have today, and they having been raised in an environment that was abusive anyway, how much more is that going to contribute to the problem of raising functional, well-adjusted adults? You don't have to be a psychohistorian. You don't even have to buy into the validity of that as a discipline to see that a lot of people from the past, were they around today, would probably be classified as having been victims of child abuse. Now, how much this affected them individually, or how much it affected their societies as a whole, well, that's, of course, open to debate and speculation. That's what we're doing here. But one of the good things about this psychohistory idea, if you buy into it, is how optimistic it is for humankind. It's got to be the most optimistic kind of history I've ever run into, because it assumes you can change the one variable in human history that seems unchangeable, humans. How often do we talk about the past and we kind of quote William Shakespeare's line about, you know, all the world's a stage and all the people merely players. And I think I've said many times that the costumes change and the scenery changes and the set design changes, but the actors in those costumes, the human beings, remain the same, you know, over the eons. The psychohistorians, though, believe that that's alterable. And if that's alterable, well, then all bets are off, right, in terms of the cycles of history and the way things are going to go in the future. For example, the psychohistorians have the stages of history we talked about, where infanticide is the first big, long stage. Well, according to them, the stage that we're in right now, they call the helping phase. And here's how they describe the helping phase of human history in terms of parenting. They say, quote, beginning in the mid-20th century, some parents adopted the role of helping children reach their own goals in life rather than socializing them into fulfilling parental wishes. Less psychological manipulation, more unconditional love. Children raised in this way are far more empathetic towards others in society than earlier generations. End quote. That last sentence is fascinating. I'm going to reread it. Children raised in this way are far more empathetic towards others in society than earlier generations. Folks, if that's true, if we are raising healthier, less traumatized, more well-adjusted humans than ever before in human history, Could that mean that the cycles of history that we're always worrying about, that we think may pull us back into the familiar patterns and calamities that all people have had to deal with throughout time, does that mean that we could possibly break that cycle? There was a column I read not that long ago from a baby boom author defending his whole generation against the charges that maybe the 1960 generation hadn't done very much to push change, which, of course, that whole generation was supposed to change the world. And this author was trying to defend the idea that really they were changing the world just in ways that were not as obvious as what people thought would happen. And his contention was the way that the baby boom generation was changing the world was by raising the best generation of kids that had ever been born on the planet, the most well-adjusted, the most well-rounded, the one that had been given the most parental love and attention, and were going to change the world due to the fact that they weren't like these earlier generations of human beings that had not had as much attention paid to their rearing. There's a quote that I love from St. Augustine, and he was actually quoted in some of these books I used for research for this program as well. And the quote he's supposed to have uttered is, "Give me other mothers, and I will give you another world." Isn't that what we're talking about here? Could you make the case, and I think the psychohistorians are, that the parents of the last 100 years who paid more attention to this than parents in the past, who've used what we would consider to be almost scientific methods compared to people of the past, could you make the case that we're beginning to reap historically in our children what we've sown? Better people? It's interesting to think about the ideas that maybe better people will be what ends up changing the world more than anything else we've accomplished over, you know, the entire history of humankind. But before we get too caught up in patting ourselves on the back and congratulating ourselves on what a great job we do compared to our ancestors, being the best parents in all human history, let's get a little perspective and realize that if our descendants ever invent that time machine that I'm always fantasizing about, and if they put it on the grab setting and take one of us into the future, 1,000, 2,000 years, start asking how we were raised and what the proper methods are to bring up a healthy, well-adjusted child, let's understand that no matter what kind of job we're doing, they're likely to see our efforts as backwards, maybe barbaric, maybe even abusive. In our defense, we could probably say that we did the best we could knowing what we know now. Of course, I have a feeling that's the same excuse our ancestors would use.
Audible is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, information, and educational programming. Content from Audible is downloaded and played back on personal computers, CDs, or iPod players. Audible offers over 80,000 hours of audio programs from 270 content partners that include leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, podcasters, and business information providers. Listen wherever and whenever you want, just like you're listening to this podcast right now. Audible has more than 1,000 science and technology titles and over 1,100 science fiction and fantasy titles, with more being added all the time. Get a free audiobook download when you sign up today. And if you don't know what to get, may I suggest a book called How Great Generals Win by Bevan Alexander. I have the hardcover version of this book on my library shelf, and I've read it several times. It's a book about the similarities in the strategies of the great captains throughout military history. If you're a military history nut, as I am, this book should be on your shelf or on your iPod. Go to audiblepodcast.com/hardcorehistory for your free audiobook download.
Do you shop online at Amazon.com? If you do, consider doing so through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com. Your shopping experience will be the same as always, but Amazon will give Dan and Ben a little kickback for sending you there. A buck a show, it's all we ask. But Dan and Ben don't care if they get it from you or from Amazon.